We're doing Mishlei. We're up to what's called the 27th chapter, the first pasuk. Shlomo Melech says, "Al titalel biyom machar." Don't take pride about what's going to be tomorrow. Ki lo teida ma yeled yom, because you don't know what tomorrow will bring, what tomorrow will bear. You just don't know. You assume, tomorrow I'll give charity. Tomorrow's going to be a great day. You don't know what will be tomorrow. This is an important concept in Judaism. There's the famous story of Rav Yonatan Eibshitz, who was rushing, and the governor saw him and said, "Where are you rushing?" And he said, "I don't know." "So what do you mean you don't know? You're rushing, you're going somewhere." He says, "I don't know where I'm going." So he threw him to jail, and he called him in 2 hours later. He says, "Now will you answer me respectfully?" He said, "I did." He said, "What do you mean? I asked you where you're going." He said, "I don't know." He said, "What do you mean you don't know?" He said, "I thought I was going to Beis Medrash, and you see, I ended up in jail. I didn't know where I was going." We know where we think we're going, where we'd like to be going, but we don't know where we are going. You didn't ask me where do I want to go, you asked me where I'm going, and the truth was I didn't know. So we don't know. That's an important concept. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. This is an important concept in many, many realms. Let's take the business realm. Everyone that makes an investment thinks it will succeed. A very successful businessman once said, the best business deal is gauged by how quick is your out. How quick can you get out of it? You want to know how good a business deal is? The gauge is how quickly can you get out? Because every investment anyone enters, they're entering because they believe it will succeed. So the fact that you have many reasons why you think that investment will succeed is irrelevant. It's relevant to a degree. But everyone who went into a business thought it would succeed. The best investment is gauged, he said, by how quick is your out. And what? That means how quickly can you get out of it? Sometimes you invest in a business, and when it goes down, you can't pull out. You can't pull out your money. You can't pull out your name. If the business destroys its reputation, your name is with it. Okay? In every investment, you have to check out. How bound are you to that investment? How quickly can you get out of that investment? How quickly can you minimize your damages? So that's an example of we don't take confidence in tomorrow, because we don't know what tomorrow will bring. Now, obviously, this does not work in family relationships. In family relationships, you invest in tomorrow. You're the one who invests in the tomorrow of your children, of your wife, of your family. Anyone who would be asked when they enter marriage, I'm not putting too much in the ksuba, because, who knows what tomorrow will bring. You can't bring a relationship like that, right? Those who want to jump off the diving board, if they're not sure how the dive is going to go and they try to leave one foot on, they get hurt. So in family relationships, you have to have confidence in tomorrow. Your confidence in tomorrow is what builds tomorrow. It's what creates tomorrow. You tell your kid, "I'm not sending you to school. I don't know what will be of you. What a waste of money. Who knows what will come of you? I'm not doing that." Okay? You give the confidence. That's what builds people. When we have confidence in them. But in other areas of life, a person has to know there's intrinsic risk and you don't know what will happen tomorrow. And the more a person can be cognizant of that, the more they will take gauged steps. You take risks in life, but if you recognize the risks, then you take them in a calculated way and you continue protecting yourself. Many people, when they invest and their stock goes up, they start spending money. You don't have money till you pulled out of the stock. A guy buys the stock at $10 and now it's at $15. And he tells me, "You know how much money I've made? Wait till it goes up some more." Okay. I had a friend who bought a medical stock. DCPI, I think it was called. This goes back about 15 years. And he bought the stock at $2. And I met him when it was at $6. And we were both young then. We must have been 19 or 20. And he had already made, I don't know how many tens of thousands of dollars. And he was so happy. And the next day, the FDA made a ruling that they couldn't get a patent on all the medication they were working. It was public domain. And their stock went from $6 to 60 cents and down to about 12 cents. He lost everything, including the principal. Now, he never pulled out. He had a profit, and he never sold. So he didn't have a profit. How many times have I seen people where they're confident because their stock is up? What confidence do you have it's going to stay up tomorrow? You pull out at least your principal, and then you're risking your profit. People have confidence in tomorrow, and then they spend what they have today. People have confidence in tomorrow, and they enter mortgages they can't afford. You guys heard the rule, live beneath your means. Live beneath your means. People say, I'm living at my means. That's wrong. You have to take 15 to 20% of what you make and put it in savings. You have to build. You want to develop your life so that you have silent income. You don't want that the only money you make is the money you work for. You want a situation where you have things that bring in the income without your working. Okay, but people will take on a mortgage because this year they made $1 million, so next year they'll make at least $1 million, right? So they take on a huge mortgage, and then what happens? That's how people destroy themselves. When people take on debt, and sometimes you have to take on debt. Of course, sometimes you have to take on a mortgage. But when you gauge what you can handle, you have to do it in a balanced way where you don't have confidence that tomorrow will necessarily be as good as today. You don't know. Al titalel biyom achar, Shlomo warns us. Shlomo HaMelech says, do not take pride, do not boast about tomorrow. Ki lo teida mayeled yom. You don't know what tomorrow will bring. One of the great mistakes that young people make is that they don't take out life insurance. You get married at 22, 24, and you assume, what do I need life insurance for? And what happens when you're 28 and you have three kids, and then you can't manage without your spouse, and she can't manage without you? Later on in life, hopefully you've settled yourself financially. But at a younger age, life insurance isn't expensive. At 25, at 28, you can buy $1 million, $2 million shekel of life insurance, and it costs you what? 50 shekel a month, 40 shekel a month. It's not a huge expense, and you're protecting your family. Shlomo warns us, Shlomo HaMelech says, you don't know what tomorrow will bring. And again, a person doesn't have to be depressed because of this. A person has to calculate their risks. Al titalel v'yom achar. This is also in terms of the mitzvos a person will do. Sometimes a person says, tomorrow I'll give charity, tomorrow I'll do this. People tend to procrastinate, and you don't know what tomorrow will bring. It says, the best time to daven mincha is the final minutes before sunset. Just as there's an idea that we should daven shacharit, just at the crack of dawn, at nates, so too there's a concept you should daven mincha just before the sun sets. Then it says in Israel they curse a person for doing that. Because how many times do you get stuck in traffic? How many times do you miss the minyan? How many times do you... Something detained you. So that doesn't work. It's a nice theory. By nates, if you miss nates, you still have 3 hours, 4 hours to daven. Yeah, but if you said, I'm going to catch those last minutes, well, who knows if those last minutes will play themselves out the way you intended. So Shlomo warns us also in the realm of doing mitzvot. You can accomplish, do it now. Don't take confidence and don't take pride in tomorrow. You don't know what tomorrow will bring. Pasuk bet. Yehalelcha zar velo fihicha. Let a stranger praise you, but not your own mouth. Nochri ve'al sefatecha. Let a foreigner praise you. Your lips should not be the ones doing your praise. And that's a challenge, especially today in job interviews. You have to, when you're dating, you have to find ways of letting the person you're dating know the positive things about you, yet you shouldn't sit there bragging. There's a balance. Yes?
I heard that you're not to brag about something like a mitzvah you keep with you. I think it was in
Show me. It says, Mefarsimim Osei Mitzvah, that we publicize those who do mitzvah. But I don't remember it saying that a person should publicize his own doing mitzvah. It says in the response of the Rashba that when a person donates something to the shul, it's good to put on a plaque because that will get other people to donate. There it says that. But again, it doesn't say that the person himself should go out and tell everyone, hey, look what I did. I don't remember such a concept, but show me. I'm happy to see. So notice that Shlomo HaMelech did not say, hide your praise. What he said is, let others sing your praise. You shouldn't sing your own praise. That means if you're going to a job interview, it's a good idea to bring a letter of recommendation. Let someone else say how great you are. When you're going for a shidduch, you should have friends who can recommend you. When people call you about a shidduch, you should be able to recommend others. We had a student here who came for 1 month. He did not have a high school diploma. Never finished high school. Came and studied here, I think it was over a month. Maybe it was 2 months. It was under 2 months, I think. And then he became ill, and he had to leave the country. And even though we begged him to stay, he said, no, he wants to be treated there. He left. So he left, fine. He was a really serious student when he was here, so I called him into the office before he left, and I said, I want to give you a letter of recommendation. He said, what am I going to do with this? I said, you're going to go for a job. You should be able to give it. He said, what can you say about me? I said, I could say the truth. And I wrote him a letter of recommendation. We had the pleasure of knowing so-and-so. He was a student by us for under 2 months or 2 months, whatever it was. And during this time, we were very impressed with his seriousness, with his diligence, with his intellectual acumen. And I was very honest. The guy calls me up, I don't know, if a month or two later. He got a job with one of the governmental offices in the United States. And he worked his way up in that office. He said he didn't have a GED, he didn't have a high school diploma. The only thing he had walking into the interview was a letter of recommendation. And himself, I guess the guy has charisma, right? But the letter was the only thing he had to show for himself. And himself, I'm not undermining that. He got the job and he kept growing in that job. Years later, after he was already married, he went back and did his GEDs and got a... Last he told me, he got a... He did get a university diploma. But that was already years after he had already gotten his first job, serious job, and he grew in that field. He grew in that office. A letter of recommendation can take you a long ways. I strongly recommend wherever you work, wherever you volunteer, wherever you study, before you leave, you go over and you ask the head of the department, you ask for a letter of recommendation. And then you can fulfill this pasuk. Ya'alelcha zar velofiha. Let a stranger praise you. Shlomo HaMelech didn't say hi to your praise. He said it shouldn't come from your lips. Let them hear it from someone else. So, okay, you can show up with a letter of recommendation. Pasuk Gimel. Shlomo says, Kovid even v'netel hachol. The weight of a heavy stone or the weight of sand. Sandbags can be very heavy. But v'cha'as evil kaved mishenehem. You know what weighs even more? The anger of an evil, the anger of a fool, carries more weight than those two. When you have a fool, so then their anger is more weighty than stones or sand. And Shlomo is warning us that when a person has anger, so then you see how smart he is. You see what his traits are. A person can be very dangerous when they have anger. I got an email this week from an alumni of ours that said he was almost killed this week because someone got upset at him on the road and tried to kill him. I don't know if he cut someone off by mistake or what. Someone tried to kill him. So when a person has anger and it goes unchecked, so they can be very dangerous. Chazal tell us, you guys know the line, a person is gauged bekoso, bekiso, bekaaso. Yeah? Koso, his cup, when he drinks alcohol. Yeah. Kiso, his wallet, his where he spends his money. Kaaso, his anger. Those are three gauges of a person. Koso, kiso, and kaaso. So, Shlomo HaMelech warns us of the anger of a fool. The anger of a fool. Pasuk Dalet. Achzariyut Chema. V'sheitef Ahaf. Shlomo HaMelech says you should know. Two interpretations in this pasuk. We'll start with one. Anger can bring a person to cruelty. And when a person allows his anger to go wild, so then sheitef af, his anger can become a deluge, and he can be completely destructive if he leaves his anger unchecked. Umi yamod lifnei kina. Who could stand up in front of someone who has jealousy, who is vengeful? How could you stand up to him? That's even worse than anger. When a person has jealousy and vengeance, so then the amount of evil a person can do out of jealousy and vengeance is even worse than the evil that can come from anger. So that's the first interpretation. When a person has jealousy, he might choose Macbeth, let us both, not Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, let us both die. Rather than, so a person is willing to do evil to others, rather than allow, out of jealousy, rather than allow a situation where he doesn't benefit but someone else does. So that's why jealousy is more dangerous even than anger. So that's the first interpretation of the pasuk. Achzariyut chema, anger is cruelty. And a person's angry. Now, sometimes people say, what do you want? I got upset. No. Take control of your anger. You need help. Get help. But a person has to know where anger can lead him. And that's why a person has to work on it. Can lead to cruelty. Am I a cruel person? I'm not a cruel person. All the people who, you know, Willie White. You guys heard of Willie White? There was a Two-Gun Crowley. These were all famous criminals. And there was a superintendent who made it his habit, a warden in a prison, who made it his habit to interview the inmates and to try to talk to them. And he said in all his years, he was in top security prison where the most violent criminals were there. You know, a Two-Gun Crowley, a police officer once stopped him and asked him for his license, and he just shot the guy, killed the guy on the spot. And Two-Gun Crowley once wrote a letter, and he says, in this body there is a wary and kind heart. You know, Al Capone described himself as a very kind person. Al Capone said, all I'm trying to do is make the amenities of life available for people. I'm trying to bring the finer things of life to make them available for people. That's how he viewed himself. So, no one looks at themselves and says, I'm cruel. But maybe my anger goes unchecked. Shlomo HaMelech says, if your anger is unchecked, you should know that that brings a person to cruelty. A person has to check themselves. Do I control my anger? Can I tell myself when I'm angry, I won't talk? I won't talk. I'll calm down. You know the Chafetz Chaim used to go in a corner, like a little boy? Chafetz Chaim used to go to a corner and start talking to himself. It's Yisrael Meir, what you getting so upset about? Yisrael Meir, you're a Kohen. Kohanim tend to get upset, so calm yourself. Yisrael Meir, no. Just because you're upset doesn't mean you should talk that way to other people. He would have a conversation with himself, telling himself to behave himself. We think of the Chafetz Chaim as having control. The Chafetz Chaim had the control to control that he wouldn't lose control. But he saw when he would. So there are tricks. Achzariyut chema v'sheitef af. And then we come to kina, jealousy. Jealousy. This is really a question of a general approach in all of life, but the challenge begins from the beginning of time. They did an experiment, which shocks all of us, but maybe it's our nature, where they asked people if they could have a raise, but their coworker who does the same job would have double the raise. Do they want the raise? And a large number of people said they don't want it. We're going to do the same job. You're not losing anything. You're getting the raise. Your coworker is getting doubled. Do you want that? And it shocks us when we hear it. But the Torah tells us that when Abel, Hevel, was born, he either had two twins to marry or he had a better looking twin to marry. And Cain went ballistic over that. Why does his brother get a better wife than he? Or two wives and he only got one. Now we can all analyze logically and say, just because he has more doesn't mean I have less. But I guess the starting point is the question of, what do I deserve? And we tend to feel like I deserve what everyone else has, and that's a normal feeling. The Meiri writes in Sanhedrin that we're wary in court of people with disabilities, because people with disabilities have a tendency to look at other people and say, why can he walk and I can't? Why can he hear and I can't? Why can he see and I can't? And so living life with that frustration that other people have the capacity to do things and they don't can lead them to be cruel towards other people. Now, again, the starting point is, how do I look at life? And in theory, it sounds so simple, but in practice, the idea that the Torah tells us from the beginning that jealousy was a constant factor, that means that's the natural tendency of man. Adam can look at all the fruits in the Garden of Eden and be told, that one which you can't have is the best one. God's keeping the best for himself. So now do you say, thank you so much for giving me all the fruits in the world? Or do you say, I can't believe you're withholding the best fruit from me? What would all of us say? Well, I can tell you what all of us do say. We say, I can't believe you're withholding the best from me, because on any given day we have a lot of blessings, and what does our Shmoneh Esrei consist of? Who has Kavana and Modim? Who can say that when they hit Modim, they're focused? When you hit Modim, you're thinking, I'm almost done and out. What are we saying, Modim? What are we thanking for? But we're very focused. The easiest part for us to focus on is when we ask God for what we want. But wait a second, he's given us so much, and yet we're not so focused on saying thank you. People don't even realize that's a part of prayer. What are we saying, Modim? What do we thank Hashem for? I'll challenge you. When do you ever thank God for being circumcised? Boom. Trick question. When do you ever thank God for the covenant of the circumcision? Nope. Does anyone know? We only say it a few times a day. No, there's a place where we say the words, I thank you, Hashem, for signing a covenant in my body. Where do we say it?
Just a second.
You said a few times a day we say it?
After the blessing, there is the parashat of Akedah.
No, so where do you say that then? Look.
Berkat HaMazon.
Thank you. In Berkat HaMazon, we thank Hashem. Ve'al beritecha shechatamta b'vsareinu. Thank you for the covenant you've sealed into our flesh. Right, but how focused are we there? No, delicha, that's the part that's like, whatever. No, that's the such a critical thing. We're thanking the Ribbono Shel Olam. But that's not our nature. In theory, we all understand it. In practice, we have a much easier time talking to the Ribbono Shel Olam about what we'd like, what we need, what we're missing. And this happens in marriage too. You ask your wife to wake you at 6 o'clock, and she doesn't. On purpose, by mistake, she doesn't. Bottom line. You get up at 7, and you have to rearrange your whole schedule. What do you say? Do you say, it's amazing that you cook, that you clean, that you take care of the kids? It's amazing that I can come home and I have a partner in life? Or do you say, did you forget? What do you say? All of us. I'm saying we look at it and we say, sure, we should be at peace with what we have, but we're not. And if our wife dares miss one thing, like waking us when we agreed she'd wake me. So then I have a question. Why didn't you? What's the question? Did you say thank you for all the things she did? Okay, so this idea that who can stand up to jealousy? Jealousy is so dangerous. We read that and we think that's about the other people who are so jealous. That's not me. I'm jealous. Well, if I look at life and I look at life with demands, so then I'm going to be jealous when I don't get those demands. When I don't get it and other people do. When I don't have what other people have. Why don't I have what other people have? Why can't I have? Why not me? So that's jealousy. Yeah.
Well, when you spoke about the practical thankfulness, so looking at your wife and saying thank you for all of those things, it sounds simple when you say it, but it's tremendous effort to get there. And how exactly... Just simple practical terms. How do you get yourself to become get on that level?
You fake it till you make it.
Even before Hashem, if you thank Hashem?
For sure. Appreciation, you begin by faking. You begin by saying, thank you. I appreciate it. That was wonderful. I have this minhag that I created in the house.
Yeah.
When we sit down for the meal and after everyone's eaten a little bit, I say to the kids, who thanked Ima for shopping and buying all this food? Who thanked Ima for putting it in the fridge? Who thanked Ima for peeling the fruits? Who helped Ima peel the fruits? Who thanked Ima for cutting the salads? And I go through the whole thing. Now, it's a fake. Did I thank Ima for buying the food and putting it in the fridge and washing it and cutting it? I try. If you try, every time you notice that your wife does the laundry, to say, thank you for doing the laundry. Thank you for folding it, and thank you for putting it away. Then you force yourself to come to a realization that she just did that. Now, again, it's not second nature, but when you fake it, then you start making it. Then you start creating that habit. It's not my invention. That's what Rambam writes in his introduction to Pirkei Avot. He says, when you want to acquire a trait, behave as though you have it, and then slowly you'll learn it and you'll have it. So in every trait, we have to fake it first. And also in towards heaven. And I'm not sure that it's completely fake. It could be that my emotion isn't yet there, but my logic is. I understand I should say thank you. I'm not yet appreciative. I should be. Yeah.
What about faking holiness?
I want to address that in a broader sense. Okay, could we wait for the Q&A?
Sure.
That has to be broken down a little bit. So, Tov. Pasuk Hey. What we learned so far? Don't take pride in tomorrow. You don't know what tomorrow will bring. Both as an attitude that to be wary of tomorrow and not to take confidence I could do a mitzvah tomorrow. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. Let me do it when I can do it. Then we learned don't praise yourself, but ensure that others give the praise when it's necessary. For example, a job interview. Then we learned that the anger of the fool is more weighty than a stone, than sand. The danger of the anger of the fool, that a person is gauged by the way they behave when they get angry. And finally, we learned about the cruelty that comes with anger. But jealousy is even more dangerous than anger, because jealousy will drive a person to the point of destroying himself with others out of jealousy. We're up to Pasuk Hey. I wrote a few weeks ago in the letter to the community, that I think that there's a component here that we're overlooking in all the terrorism that's going on here, and that's the component of jealousy. So the only understanding I have of how a person can be so cruel to the hand that feeds them, where a person who was cured in a hospital can come back to detonate that hospital. The hospital saved the person's life or the child's life, and people are willing to perform terrorist acts against that hospital, the very hospital that saved their life. So I said that, and in general, I'm saying the Arabs in Israel have it better than Arabs anywhere else. There's no Arab country that treats them as well as we do. So I wrote that
What? You give them special things. College, I heard someone say that that there's not as checking of their taxes and all that. So
we do a lot, yeah. We used to circumcise, we used to learn how to circumcise by circumcising Arab children. The Arabs would bring a bunch of kids and say, "You guys circumcise them, we'll pick them up in an hour." And then, seriously, they do them like 15 at a time, 20 at a time, and that would be an opportunity. They don't care. They bring kids all ages.
Okay.
And that used to be, like, they didn't care who does it so long as it was done correctly. Now, just like a medical hospital, it's safe, but you learn on the patients. I'm saying, so that's how we used to learn. Today, the government gives free circumcisions in the hospital to any Arab that wants. They come in at any age. They get an appointment, they get a circumcision. So we no longer have that. I'm saying it used to be they'd come to a moel and they'd say, do it for us. Today, that's just an example. Even the Arabs that are in the prisons, they get free dental treatment and they get free schooling to get degrees. So I said that I think one component that we're overlooking is the jealousy factor. No one likes someone when they're so good to you and they're so kind to you. How could you be so evil to them? It's jealousy. So I think that's also a component of what's going on today, what we're seeing all around us. And that's Shlomo HaMelech over here warns that jealousy is more dangerous than anger. Jealousy can bring a person to places that they'll destroy themselves. At the end of the day, if we're not in power, they're worse off. Again, just look statistically at what's going on around us. Pasuk Hei. Jealousy leads to anger. Shabbat shalom. We'll miss you tomorrow morning. Stay safe and warm. Say the good. Good. Later. Jealousy can lead to anger. Yeah. Yeah. Can. Yeah. Pasuk hey. Tova tochachat megula me'ahava mesutaret. The mem in may, the words mean revealed rebuke is good from love that's hidden. So what does that mean? It could mean it's better. Better revealed rebuke than hidden love. Our sages said that if someone rebukes you, even if they're doing it openly, but if it stems, may ahava mesutaret, if it stems from hidden love, then it's good for you. Tova tochachat megula, revealed rebuke is good when it comes from hidden love. If I think back in my life, I've had numerous times where people gave me over the head. When it came from hidden love or revealed love, then it was positive. I always tell the story that we once had a class when we lived in the neighborhood. I told you guys this story? Okay, we used to live a 10-minute walk from here. So very often the guys would come over and we'd have class at home. Like once every 2-3 weeks we'd have class at home, nice atmosphere. So one time, a minute before the guys show up, there's a knock on the door. And someone brings me a donation to help a family, and he gives me cash. I don't remember how many thousands of shekels. Okay, he leaves. I close the door just after I lock the door, there's a knock on the door. The guys from the machon are there. So I'm standing there holding all this cash, and the kids are sleeping in the other room, and there's a knock on the door. I didn't know what to do. I went into the kitchen. I put down the money, and I went back and answered the door, and we all sat in the living room and learned. And I'm fine. We finished the learning. The guys leave, and I go back to put the cash together with the tzedakah money, and it's all gone. So now what am I supposed to do? I'm looking up, down. I remember where I left it. It's not there. I called Rav Listman, and I said, I'm very sorry to tell you, but there were only two students who used the facilities who got up during the learning. And then they went to the kitchen to wash their hands. What are we supposed to do? They were the only two who were in the kitchen. I don't remember if there was 1,000 or 2,000 shekel there on the table, I said. So he said to me, you have no idea, and I don't know what you want me to do, but we're not going to start doubting our students. No. I said to him, I know the money was there, and I know it's not there now. He said, what do you want me to do? I said, maybe we should ask them. He said, you want, you can go ask them, but I don't see it. I said, I don't want to hurt a student, you know, it's one of two. So that means one of them is going to be blamed unfairly, and that could really devastate a person when you ask them such a question. I didn't know what to do. So I was a little bit in despair, and I wasn't sure what to do. So about an hour and a half later, I'm turning the whole house over. I'm trying to figure out where it couldn't have fallen behind the table. I look. Okay, an hour and a half later, I open a drawer in the kitchen, and there's the money. Must be, I didn't remember correctly. I thought I left it on the kitchen table. I had left it in the drawer. Everything's there, perfect. Nothing budged. So I called Rav Listman, and I said, you won't believe it. It's a good thing we didn't ask any of the students. We'd have embarrassed two students for nothing. All the money's there. So I'm about to hang up, and he says to me, what did we learn from this? And I said, I shouldn't have suspected students so fast. I said, I'm not sure that's the real lesson, because from the facts I knew, that what else was I supposed to think? I said, but he said, no, that's not what I mean. I said, okay, so tell me, what am I supposed to learn from this? He said, promise me that never again will you have money in your hands and leave it lying somewhere. Money doesn't go lying somewhere. Even if there's a knock on the door, you take an envelope, you label it, you put it away, and the people will wait at the door. I want you to think about it. Now, when Rav Listman said it to me, I felt like a little boy, right? Someone's wagging their finger at you. I hung up the phone, and till today, every time that money comes into my hand, I hear Rav Listman's voice saying, promise me you're not going to do that again. Now, if he wouldn't have stopped me and said, what do you learn from this? I would have repeated the mistake. He's right. That's not the way to handle the money. So there's a knock at the door. So the guys will wait another minute. Let me label it. Let me put it away. It's uncomfortable. They're knocking. They're waiting. So what? You see what happened? He's 100% right. But I wouldn't have known it. I would have continued making the mistake. If he wouldn't have stopped me in my tracks and said, what do you learn from this? I would not have learned anything from it. Shlomo HaMelech tells us, Tova tochachat megula me'ava mesutaret. When there's revealed rebuke, when someone comes and tells you, hey, learn from this, you have to change something. But you realize that their intentions are good. They're here to help you. That's something good. That's something good. Now, it's true that giving rebuke is something which very often plays itself out in a way. The word tochachat comes from the word vikuach, comes from the word nochach, which means opposite, like opposing. If someone's giving me over the head, then they're opposing me. But they're not. The wisdom here is to know how to do it so that the person understands that you have their best interest at heart. Meaning, very often people can destroy relationships by giving the other person advice, by correcting them, by rebuking them. No one wants to hear that. There are exceptions, and those exceptions are when the person can be confident that they're doing it for the other person's benefit. So I'll tell you a comical scene that happened tonight. I stopped at the store where I buy the cakes, right? the cake I brought to the first class, the chocolate cake. So there, you guys see that cake. So I stopped at that store to pick up the cake. And I have a friend who works in the store. So every so often I bring him a drink. So as I'm leaving the store, he says, "You didn't bring me a drink?" I said, "Actually, I did. I take out the drink. I bring him a drink." And I said, "But I want you to taste it. I want to know if it's good." Because the guy who sold it to me wasn't sure if it's good. I want to know for the future. So he obliges. He picks up the bottle. Now he's in the middle of working. He picks up the bottle and goes, "Baruch Hashem Kamechlam Shakoni B'Toro," and then proceeds to open the bottle and drink from it. So another person standing there, after he takes a sip, tells him, "You don't make a blessing that way. There isn't supposed to be a pause between your blessing and drinking from the bottle. You should open the bottle, have it ready to drink, then make the blessing so you could drink right after you open the bottle." So the guy, another guy standing next to the second guy, looks at him and says, "Only a nincompoop would stand and rebuke someone else publicly." I'm thinking, what did he just do? And he goes on and he says to him, if he had too long a pause before he drank the Coke, you did a biblical transgression. You embarrassed him in front of the whole store. And I'm thinking, well, what did you just do? I just burst out laughing. I'm watching it and I'm seeing him tell, you know, the first guy tells him you shouldn't drink, and the second guy tells the first guy, "What do you?" Okay, so that's the challenge. Tovat tochachat megula me'avan mesutaret. Rebuke is good when the other side really senses that there's real love there, that you really care. The most destructive things in marriage. The most destructive thing in marriage is rebuke. The thing that destroys most marriages is that people give advice, make a slight comment, and they don't mean badly. I'm just saying, if you would do it this way, wouldn't it be better? Yeah, you're just saying. So this concept that Shlomo HaMelech is talking about is rarely applicable. Most of the time, when you're rebuking someone, you're destroying, you're not building. My teachers, the ones that I learned from later on in life, never rebuked. But what they did do, and till today, I don't know if they really did this or it was in the eye of the beholder, but if I would do something wrong, a month later or 2 months later, somewhere in a class, they would discuss it, and I would learn that that was improper. And it happened a few times until once I stopped one of the teachers and I said, "Come on, be straight with me. Are you mentioning this in class because I did this and this a month and a half ago?" And he looked at me straight in the face and said, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And he looked me straight in the eye to the point where till today, I don't know. But I suspect it happened too many times that weeks later, they mentioned something which I had made a mistake on earlier, and I learned a lot from it. So you could say their teachings were just applicable to life, so I learned from it. But I don't think so. I think they did it because they didn't want to rebuke me directly. I wasn't on the defensive. They brought it up as an example. They brought it up as we were learning. So this idea of Shlomo HaMelech in our day and age is almost inapplicable. I gave you the example of Rav Listman where I learned a lot from it. But I'm saying for most circumstances, the person receiving the rebuke does not take it as me'ava mesutaret. They don't see that there's real closeness behind that. And that's why it's destructive. I tell parents, if you can tell me that for every word of rebuke you've given 20 words of love, then I could hear that you've given rebuke. But 20 words of love means with the same emotion, with the same ferocity as when you give rebuke. How does a person give rebuke? "I can't believe you did that! Do you ever say, 'You are amazing'? Do you ever get so excited about something positive? Or when it's negative, then, we could put in all the fervor. This is terrible. You should be embarrassed of yourself." Right? You said something. Now, what do you say when the kid does something great? "You're amazing." You know, there's a Hasidic school in Netanya. In Netanya? I don't remember where. We have friends from the neighborhood who moved out of the neighborhood, in this neighborhood. They moved out of the neighborhood for a few years to help build a yeshiva. And when they were there, the only frum school they could send to was a Hasidic school. And then after a few years, they came back here. So we asked them, how was the schooling there? So they said the schooling there was amazing. We said, what was so good about it? So the mother told us, she said, when a kid said a good pshat in class, when the Rebbe would ask a question and the kid would give a good answer, the Rebbe was capable of picking up the kid, putting him on his shoulders and dancing all around the class and saying, you are amazing! He said, yeah, a kid gets that, so he gets excited over learning Torah. And I said to myself, wow, where do you find educators who give such excitement when the kid gets it right? And that's a question to us, as parents. They asked one of the Gedolim, I think the Rav of Brisk, why he was so into learning Torah. And he said, the moment that is etched in his memory is his mother had bought a new blouse, which everyone knew she was saving this new dress for Pesach. And it was a month before Pesach, and he came home and he said to his mother that he had just finished his first tractate. And his mother said, really? Today you finished your first tractate? She went and spread out Shabbos, a white tablecloth on the table, and she set the table Shabbos stick, and she went and put on that new garment and made a shechiyonah. So he looked at her and he said, but we were saving that for Yom Tov. And she said, right, but your father's going to come home, and this is a bigger celebration for me than Yom Tov. And he said, that etched in his mind the importance of his learning Torah. That, seeing his mother put on that garment. So when we say, yeah, rebuke is good when it comes from hidden love, and I say, wait, where's that love? There was once a couple that asked the rabbi, is it immodest to show love in front of the kids? And the rabbi said, it's more immodest to show hate. Why do you ask me about showing love, but you don't ask me about saying hateful words to one another in front of the kids? When you'll be as careful not to show hate, then talk to me about not showing love. So I'm not saying you should kiss and do the other things that belong in the bedroom in front of the kids. But there is this concept that there has to be that revealed affection, and the positive emotions have to come out with strength. And being that we're weak at that, that's why rebuke is something that's so destructive in our generation, because we don't give the strength, we don't give the positive feedback as forcefully as we should. If a child got 20 compliments that were as forceful as one word of rebuke, then he could handle the rebuke. When was the last time anyone in this classroom can remember that they got a powerful comment, a powerful positive comment? Does anyone remember? You remember? When was it?
It was during the summer months. It was in August.
Months ago. So I'm asking, and you could probably count, at least on one hand, if not two, how many negative comments you've gotten since then. That's a frightful thing. One person in the classroom can remember the last time they got a powerful, positive comment. But that reflects on us. It's not only society.
Yeah, Rob, I can remember several powerful, positive things that were said during this week to fellow students.
Yeah.
In various Beautiful. Classes, including today, in today's afternoon class, Rob said something very nice.
Yofi?
Sometimes during the morning sessions.
That's beautiful.
He lifted students up. I was really amazed at the things that he said to students.
Yefe. Maybe yeah. That's why I was able to get rebuke from him. Because I got so much positive from him. Rav Listman is really exceptional.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I he calls that our office.
Yeah.
I got yelled at him once in all the years I'm teaching here. You know, once when a student... prospective student came and asked me about the Machon, and then he asked, what's the tuition at the Machon? And I called Rav Listman, and Rav Listman said, let him come in and we'll talk and we'll see if this place works for him, and he works for us and it's a good shidduch. And the student said, I don't want to go in until I know the tuition cost. So I called Rav Listman back and I said, he doesn't want to come till he knows the tuition cost. And Rav Listman said, let him come and we'll see if it works. And I said, he doesn't want to come unless he knows the cost. And that was the one time Rav Listman got upset at me. The one time I can remember. I'm here over a decade. And he said to me, Machon Meir is not about money. How can you talk to a student about money? How do you do that? You know us. First, we have to see if it matches. If it matches, we have to find a solution. But that's how can you talk to a student about money when you're talking about his whole life? Let him figure out if it works or it doesn't work. That's the first question. That was the only time. okay, so yeah, I guess if you guys are in Rav Listman's class, you have that advantage. But think outside Rav Listman's class for a minute. Think of the rest of life. Your roommates, your classmates. I'm sure if you think about it, many people have given you harsh comments. And it could be the guy. I told you guys the story about the girl with CP, right? Earlier in the week. The girls with, yeah. No one remembers. Okay. There was a family that was moving from a small town where the girl knew everyone from when she was born. And she was going, she had a few years left for high school. And her parents said, you have to move with us. And she said, but I want to stay and finish high school with all my friends here. And they said, yeah, but you have a younger sister with CP and we need you. We're moving to the big city. We need you to help with her. So she moved. What could she do? She moved with her parents. And one day she took her younger sister to the doctor's office. And as they're waiting, she's sitting by the doctor's office. And her sister goes up and walks over to the woman sitting across the aisle from them and says to her, that's a beautiful yellow pin you're wearing. And it matches with the coat you're wearing and the way you have that scarf on. You're put together so beautifully. Wow. And the woman's radiating. She got this compliment from the girl. And the girl comes back and sits down next to her. So the older sister looks at the younger sister. Now she's been hanging around just to help out with her. And she says to her, how do you do that? So she said, what do you mean? She said, aren't you embarrassed? You never met that person. You're walking over and you're complimenting her. It made her very happy, but how do you do that? Isn't it hard? So the younger sister said, yeah, it is hard. But it's harder to walk. Because she has CP, she said, it's harder to walk. Meaning the walk across the aisle was harder. So the older sister writes, she says, now I didn't know what to say. What am I going to say about myself? Walking for me is easy. And do I ever go and give someone such compliments? She started demanding that of herself. So we, even strangers, if you sit in the wrong place in the doctor's office, they're going to be very comfortable telling you what's wrong with you. Why are you sitting there? Someone already sat there. You're cutting us in line. Or they're going to give you vile comments, free of charge. But how many people would give positive comments? And so we go through life, and we have a shortage in our life. Shlomo HaMelech says you can give good rebuke, and it's good for the person when there's clear love behind it. And unfortunately, most people can't say they have that, even in their marriage. Even there, a person can't. Most people cannot say that they've given enough. They interviewed many rabbis whose fathers were chief rabbis, great rabbis of Israel. And they all said that they don't remember their father ever rebuking them. They cannot remember their father ever telling them a bad word. That doesn't mean they didn't guide them, but they guided them through the positive. How you do that, I don't know. I honestly, I don't know. I don't know. I think that part of parenting, you have to tell a kid that's wrong. You can't do that. But maybe they just don't remember. I don't know. But bottom line, the fact that they don't remember says a lot. That means that wasn't the major thing in the education. We'll do one more pasuk. It's really a follow-up to this pasuk. Shlomo HaMelech says, Ne'emanim pitzei ohev. When someone who loves you wounds you, you can be confident that it's good for you. It could be that I was walking with my wife in Mea Shearim. We were newly married, and we were about to walk off the sidewalk in between two cars, and suddenly I saw the car in the front going reverse. So my wife was in danger. She had just set foot in between the cars, and I yelled and pulled her away from just before the car hit her. A guy standing 3 feet down from me didn't see what happened. All he saw was me yelling, yank my wife. So he looks at me and he's like, that's not how you treat a wife. And I turned red and I thought to myself, he loves me. He doesn't know me. And he's saying something for my own good. He thinks I just yelled at my wife and pulled her, right? What does he think? What did that just look like to him? But ne'emanim pitzei ohev. When someone who loves you, who cares for you, does something, then you have faith in it. They had right intentions. They didn't do that for a wrong reason. Ve'natarot nishikot sonei. Shlomo HaMelech tells us, when someone who hates you kisses you, so then every kiss is extra, is more than you need. This pasuk was quoted when Arafat used to hand out his kisses to everyone. Na'atarot nishikot sonei. Someone who hates you, every kiss is one too much. You have to be careful. Esav comes to kiss Yaakov, so Yaakov's life is in danger because he's ready to kill him the minute he kisses him. That the external action is not what really counts. What really counts is what's behind it. And that's what it says in Halacha, that a child who really loves his father will sometimes make him work. Sometimes the best thing for the parent is to work. Sometimes it's not good for the parent to be home doing nothing. Sometimes if the parent is home doing nothing, then the king will put him in the armed forces and work him to death. He won't live a week. That was a common occurrence in the days of Chazal. So Chazal said, sometimes, kibbut aveim, you want to take care of your parents, then employ them, give them a job. In our day and age, sometimes retiring is not good for the parents. Slowing down might be good for them, but having nothing to do all day might be bad for them. So we don't only look at the external action. It says, when someone comes and asks you for charity, the question of your attitude to the person carries more weight than what you've given them. A person, when he gives tzedakah, has to smile, has to give the person a positive feeling. It says in Halacha, if you can't give him money, sometimes you can give him an ear. You could listen to him. You could share in his pain. You could show him that you care. The attitude is pivotal. And this is true in the laws of tzedakah. This is true in the laws of kibud av v'aim. Whenever we treat other people, a major component is what's the underlying emotion. So, ne'emanim pitzei ohev. When a relative does something, even if it's painful, if it's someone who really loves you, you can have faith that it's for your own benefit. Again, it has to be someone that you have faith that they really want what's good for you. There was once a student who I learned with for many years, and once he said something that was very wrong. And I said, I really apologize. He said, what's wrong? I said, if I loved you enough, I would smack you. But I'm not on that level. And I apologize. I should be there, but I'm not. So I'm not going to. But if I were really a good Rebbe, Rav Kook smacked someone. He said, if I were really a good Rebbe, if I cared enough for you and I knew that you knew enough that I care for you, that's what you need right now. What you said is completely off the wall. But I'm not going to do it. And I apologize. It's wrong with me. But what can I do? I'm limited. But that has to be clear. Again, it has to be clear not only to the giver, but also to the recipient. There has to be that confidence that he's only doing it because it's for my benefit. So ne'emanim pitzei ohev, but that ohev has to be very, very clear. And we tend to be overconfident, even in educating. I remember I once asked one of our children when they were little, why do they think parents punish? And the child looked at me with a stunned look, like, I don't know. I said, you really don't know? And the kid says, no, I don't know. And that was an eye-opener to me, that the child really didn't understand. We sat down and spoke about it. But we tend to take for granted that our children take for granted that we love them. And that shouldn't be taken for granted. Meaning it has to be stated, but it also has to be expressed in many ways. I'll tell you something just as a parent. Bezrat Hashem, you'll all have children. I asked myself if my kids get enough kisses from their parents. So I played a game with them. I went to the... I guess 1-year-old or 2-year-old, and I said, I'm going to wish you good night, and I'm going to give you 20 kisses. And I gave her 20 kisses. And then the 4-year-old said, what about me? So I said, okay. So I went over to the 4-year-old. And then the six-year-old said, and what about me? So I went over to the six-year-old. And I thought I was done. And then the six-year-old said, you only gave me on one cheek, I got another cheek. And it went up the ranks, up to the 11, 12-year-old. And it just showed me how much the kids really need it. We think that I've kissed them, I've hugged them, you know, they know I love them. No, children need a lot, and it's very common that we tend to think they've gotten it. No, they need more, and we have to find the opportunities to give it in different ways, but to give it to the children. So when ne'emanim pitzei ohev, we cannot be so confident, just as we mentioned in marriage, that people tend to think it's obvious that I love her, I mean for her best, and it's not at all obvious, and it's not at all heard that way. And it goes the other way too. You know, when our wives rebuke us, we don't hear it that way. And the same is true in every relationship. There's a tendency to think the other side knows how much I like them. No, they don't. They really don't. It's not as obvious as we think. We will learn later on, Shlomo Melech says, Kamayim apanim lapanim, that a person's heart reflects your heart. But a person doesn't always recognize what your heart says. It's not always so clear. We have to ensure that we express it and not be so confident they know. Parents said to a child, succeed in the test, so I'll love you. So afterwards, an educator asked the parent, don't you realize what the child heard? They heard that if they don't succeed in the test, you won't love them. And the parent said, can't be. Doesn't the child know I love him either way? And the answer is no. The parent put their own love in question. And this, people make this mistake in many relationships. We cannot assume the other person knows what we really feel. It's not a given at all. Tough to be continued.